Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump signed three more executive orders Saturday, including a plan to defeat the Islamic State, a reorganization of the National Security Council, and a three-year expansion of the lobbying ban on administration officials. He signed his latest executive actions in the Oval Office, surrounded by his staff and a group of reporters. When questioned about Friday's executive order for suspension of visas from countries of particular concern, the president said,
"It's not a Muslim ban, but we're totally prepared. It's working out very nicely. You see it at the airports. You see it all over. It's working out very nicely. And we're going to have a very, very strict ban, and we're going to have extreme vetting, which we should have had in this country for many years."
But VOA's Lisa Schlein reports the UN Refugee Agency says there is no merit to a claim by the president that Syrian refugees threaten national security and should be banned from entering the United States.
UNHCR spokeswoman Vanina Mestrachi rejects assertions that Syrian refugees are terrorists. She says refugees are victims of terrorists, and those proposed for resettlement are among the most vulnerable people on earth. They include women and children, people with disabilities, and serious medical needs. She tells VOA that refugees undergo a very rigorous screening process before they are admitted to the U.S. for resettlement.
"I think it's fair to say that refugees coming into the United States to be resettled are some of the most vetted individuals entering the United States."
And a U.S. federal judge has issued an emergency order temporarily barring the U.S. from deporting people from nations subject to President Trump's travel ban. This is VOA News. President Trump this Sunday is holding talks by telephone with three world leaders: the King of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates, and the acting President of South Korea. During Saturday's call with Russian President Vladimir Vladimir Putin, the two agreed to cooperate on efforts to defeat the Islamic State group and work together for peace in Syria and throughout the world. Tribal and local sources say the U.S. has conducted a commando raid in central Yemen, killing at least three alleged senior al-Qaeda leaders and wounding civilians. Sources say the U.S. troops used drones and helicopters in that Sunday morning strike. U.S. officials have yet to say whether they carried out such a raid. The U.S., however, is the only force operating drones over Yemen. Syrian media and key monitoring groups say government forces outside Damascus have regained control of a freshwater spring that supplies the capital after reaching a deal that allows rebel fighters dug in at the site to withdraw. The government advance sets the stage for an end to a nearly six-week standoff at the supply village northwest of Damascus that began with a December 22nd explosion at a key processing plant. That blast sent diesel fuel spewing into a river, contaminating supplies and creating severe water shortages that changed daily life for most of the capital's 5.5 million residents. Officials in Myanmar say that a legal advisor to the country's ruling National League for Democracy Party has been shot dead outside Yangon's international airport. Goni, a prominent member of Myanmar's Muslim minority, was gunned down as he was waiting for a taxi outside the airport. He just returned after an overseas trip. A taxi driver was wounded in that attack. Officials say the gunman has been arrested. A presidential spokesman says the suspect was detained and questioned. Swiss tennis star Roger Federer has defeated Spaniard Rafael Nadal in a marathon five-set match to win the Australian Open and capture his 18th Grand Slam title. The win is Federer's fifth Australian Open title and his first at a major tournament since he won the 2012 Wimbledon Championship. Federer and Nadal have played 35 times, with Nadal leading 23-12 and 6-3 in Grand Slam finals, including a win over Federer in the 2009 Australian Open. In the women's final on Saturday, American women's tennis star Serena Williams defeated her own sister Venus Williams in straight sets, 6-4, 6-4. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
There are quite a few very critical items on the agenda. One of those items would be the reforms of the African Union, which, of course, they retreated.
African leaders meet in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
Cameroon is not one and indivisible because the people have been living without communications for the past 2 weeks and the government keeps arresting people arbitrarily.
English-speaking Cameroonians urge the government to stop arresting opponents.
Gipso says the boycott is being respected by Ping's supporters. He says people do not love President Ali Bongo.
And the main opposition party in Gabon calls on members to boycott going to the stadium to watch the ongoing African Nations Cup. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African leaders meet at the African Union Summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Key among the issues on the agenda include electing a new chairperson of the commission, as well as finding ways to finance activities of the continental body. For more about the summit, I reached Jacob Ino Eben, spokesperson for the outgoing chairperson of the African Union Commission.
The summit proper will be tomorrow, 30th, and on Tuesday, 31st. And there are quite a few very critical items on the agenda. One of those items would be the reforms of the African Union, which, of course, the retreat is already discussing today, and then they'll be moving forward to making some decisions tomorrow. The second would be that on the issue of financing the AU, they will be reviewing the decisions that they took last summit in Kigali. They will be reviewing the level of implementation. But another very critical issue is the election of members of the commission, which, as you well, took place in Kigali, but they were inconclusive. So the mandate of the outgoing commission was extended, and so these elections will be taking place during the summit between Monday and Tuesday. We're looking forward to the election of the new members of the commission, the chairperson, deputy chairperson, and eight commissioners.
Talking about reforms that these heads of state will be reviewing, what do they want to see? Don't they think that the African Union has been functioning effectively for the past few years? What is the significance of these reforms?
That's a very, very, very good question. When they gave the mandate to President Kagame in Kigali to begin a process of the reform, they said they wanted an organization that was going to be more effective, more efficient in the way they manage the affairs of the continent. Particularly, they wanted to see an African Union that would be better placed to implement the continental transformation agenda, Agenda 2063, which was adopted 3 years ago, and the first 10-year implementation plan is on course. And an African Union, both the commission as well as organs, to be effective in how they implement. So we are looking forward to hearing from President Kagame and his team that he put together, reporting to the heads of state and then discussing and coming out with some very critical decisions that is going to help the African Union to be far more effective and efficient, and also to really render services better than it's been doing before.
Talking about financing the commission, the commission has had issues of financing its army or possible standby army that will intervene in areas where there are conflicts and all that. People have expressed concern that the African Union appears not to have the financial muscle to finance all of its project. How do you think these heads of state could possibly come up with solutions to resolve these concerns?
Indeed, that's one of the reasons why they are carrying out this reform, but particularly the decision that was taken in Kigali last July to impose a 0.2% levy on eligible imports into the continent in order to raise the necessary financing for the running of the activities and programs of the organization. If you would recall, the African Union, the same heads of state, took a decision in January 2015 to say that 100% of the operational budget must be funded by the African Union, 75% of the program budget should be funded by the AU, and 25% of peace operations budget should be funded by the AU. Now, this means that they've recognized that there is a challenge. Of course, the issue of international peace and security lies principally its responsibility of the United Nations. And so this decision is to enable them to raise 25% of the necessary resources that is needed, but working in collaboration with the United Nations and other international partners to raise the remaining 75% in order to ensure that our peacekeeping, peace operations missions are properly funded to prevent the sort of situation that we see currently where there are challenges of funding these missions.
So are there any assurances that this time around after the summit, there will be a new chairperson to lead the commission and other commissioners?
It is important to state that this time around, as opposed to last time, this time around we have five candidates that are running for the position. We hope that the elections will be conclusive this time around, because surely the heads of state wouldn't want to send a signal to the rest of the world that there are challenges in electing someone to lead the affairs of the commission.
Jacob Eno Eben is the spokesperson for the outgoing chairperson of the African Union Commission. He spoke with me from Addis Ababa. Residents in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon are expressing concern that the government is undermining their freedom of expression. This as internet connections appear to have been cut in the major towns of the regions for the last 2 weeks. The action also followed an intensified months-long strike by local lawyers and teachers. A consortium comprising civil society groups in the regions have been calling on the government to stop arresting opponents. For the latest update, I read Tapang Ivo Tanku, interim leader of the consortium.
The latest development is that the government has been very hard on West Cameroon, which it calls one and indivisible. So from the latest development, the cut of the internet to the western part of Cameroon, that is the English-speaking regions, we are talking here about nearly 8 million citizens. It shows that Cameroon is not one and indivisible, because the people have been living without communications for the past 2 weeks, and the government keeps arresting people arbitrarily. That means at the moment, there have been secret arrests taking place in the night, and there is even a report about a mass grave in Swa, which is a neighborhood about 30 minutes away from the capital city of Yaoundé. So basically, it is very, very traumatizing for women and girls, most especially, to wake up in the morning to notice that the boys and the husbands have been taken away by the regime forces.
I understand there is a consortium of opposing views who are agitating and causing such instability and such chaos and tension in the country, and that is why the government had to move in to ensure law and order.
No. The consortium is a conglomerate of civil society organizations. That means within the English-speaking regions, all citizens have gathered to bury their grievances as one under the consortium. So the consortium is a representation of civil society organizations. So I happen to be the interim leader of the consortium because all the members of the consortium, the leaders, have been arrested. And some have fled out of the country, Barrister Bobga Harmony, and others are seeking asylum in some of the Western embassies in Cameroon. So basically, we are advocating for non-violent approaches towards advancing democracy, the rule of law, and good governance. Under the consortium, we are not seeking for cessation, but we are very clear on our stance, and our ultimate goal is a two-state federation.
Supporters of the government are saying that there has been agitation in Western Cameroon and that the agitation is caused by the consortium because it is creating unnecessary tension. Consortium has failed to engage the government in a dialogue to resolve some of your concerns. Why hasn't the consortium done this?
Peter, the 34-year regime forces have been very instrumental in pushing forth provocations to Western Cameroonians. That means they have militarized the entire West Cameroon. They have provoked our children not to go to school because they cannot be studying under tense conditions and under fear. Recently, we've released a 73-page human rights report, and everything is well documented. So you can imagine, we've been asking for one thing, dialogue. And the regime has been of bad faith and bringing in, I can call them, mediators who are of bad faith and trying to separate the West Cameroonians into regions. So they've been holding pockets of dialogue meetings that are not binding to the entire West Cameroonians. So how do you expect those dialogue meetings to be very effective? It all started with the lawyers protesting and wanting a common law system. Then it transgressed to the teachers who also want better conditions. Then the consortium came in to bury these grievances or to speak as one and ask for one thing. The ultimate goal is a two-state federalism, which will solve these problems.
Supporters of the government are saying that the agitation was purposely created to destabilize the government and to overthrow the legitimate president who was elected in a constitutional democracy in Cameroon, and that this is the objective of the consortium or the Southerners to ensure Paul Biya goes. Is this the case?
It is not the case. President Paul Biya, what we are witnessing in Cameroon at the moment is negative peace, which means the country has always been destabilized and the country has always been very, very polarized. Negative peace is when both parties, I will call them West Cameroonians and French Cameroon, La République, as the French people will call them, both groups or both parties have never, ever integrated since 1961. There has never been equality. There is no war, but yet the integration is absent and widely absent. So Cameroon is teetering on the brink of a civil war because both West Cameroonians and French Cameroons, they do not integrate. They do not cooperate effectively. And there is destabilization taking place because the regime, which has been in power for 34 years, has never, ever called for dialogue with all relevant stakeholders.
Tapang Ivo Tanku is the interim leader of the Cameroonian Consortium. He spoke with me from New York. In December, Rainer's Bible Church International in New York, Akwa Ibom State, Nigeria, collapsed, killing scores of people. The tragedy led to the establishment of a commission of inquiry. It has ended public hearings and is now working on the final report. Many facts emerged, including claims and counterclaims between the Oyo Capital City Development Authority and the church founder Akan Weeks over securing approval for the building. For VOA, Dixon Salami Adama has more from Oyo.
The commission, which was set up by Governor of the State, Udom Emmanuel, has also been tasked to effectively resolve the varied disputes arising from the tragedy which occurred during the bishopric ordination of the church founder, Apostle Akan Weeks. Chairman of the commission, Justice Umokoyo Esang, retired, at the inaugural sitting called for memorandum from members of the public, saying that they will rely on undisputable evidence made available to them by reputable associations, experts, and individuals with useful information. In his remarks, the State Attorney General and Commissioner for Justice, Uemedimu Woko, urged members of the commission not to leave any stone unturned in justifying the reason that the commission was set up. He said the setting up of the commission came at a critical time in the history of the state, stressing that they must come up with a report that would serve as a valuable guide to both the government and the public in order to forestall future occurrence of such events. However, the first task undertaken by the commission was to order the State Commissioner of Police to release Mr. Aniete Augustine, the architect who was said to have overseen the church construction. The state government had immediately ordered Augustine's arrest after the incident. Counsel to Augustine, Mr. Ekanem, said his client's release will expose many hidden facts on the church collapse, adding that he was being detained unjustly. The chairman of Akwa Ibom State Correspondent Chapel of the Nigerian Union of Journalists, Dennis Udoma, who led the team of journalists to monitor the public hearing, spoke on the issue.
The expectation is that the commission will come out with a white paper that will be able to fashion out blames on whoever is culpable. Either Akanwicks, the founder of the church, or even those people that were involved in various stages of construction of the church. Aside from that, we are expecting that government should contribute to the burial and even the upkeep of those who had some serious injuries during the accident.
A resident of Uyo, Mrs. Ashimari Idongesi, who witnessed the tragedy, bears her mind on the people's expectation at the end of the commission's work.
I pray that this would not be one of those jamborees usually put up by the state government to appear to be working. I just hope that whatever the commission sees and discover from this inquiry would be used to the letter in a way that would give victims of the collapsed church building some sense of justice. The understanding of what has been revealed by the commission is that the whole area was marked out as a government forest reserve area. In any case, from the hearing, we all saw that fingers were pointed at the general overseer of the church. We do hope that the government will not try to shield anyone in this case. We do hope that justice will be done to serve as deterrent to others so that whenever we want to embark on a project, everything we do must be approved by appropriate quarters to avoid setting traps that will take people's life just like that.
As the Commission of Inquiry is winding down its work in order to bring out its final report, there are high expectations from the members of the public, especially the families of those who lost their loved ones. In the meantime, anger, anxiety, rumors, claims and counterclaims remains order of the day. For VOA, this is Dixon Salami Adama, reporting from Uyo, South Nigeria.
At the ongoing Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon, many seats in the stadiums remain empty. This after the political opposition led by Jean Ping, the former chairman of the African Union Commission, called on supporters to boycott the tournament. For the VOA, Moki Edwin Kenziga has more from the Gabonese capital, Libreville.
Hundreds of secondary school students are lining up at the government high school in the center of Libreville to receive entry tickets for AFCON matches.
Pour servir en classe et puis demander aux élèves qui veulent les billets.
16-year-old Yumbi Bertrand says their class master gives them tickets and sums ranging from $5 to $10 to go to the pitches to watch matches. A bus transports them to the stadium and then takes them home after. But despite the distribution of free tickets around the capital, the stands were not full for many of the matches in the group round. It's a contrast to the packed stadiums back in 2012 when Gabon co-hosted AFCON with Equatorial Guinea. This year, Gabon opposition leader Jean Ping urged people to boycott the event to protest last year's disputed presidential election. Martin Gupso was deputy director of Ping's campaign. Gupso says the boycott is being respected by Ping's supporters. He says people do not love President Ali Bongo and want him out and are using the tournament as a political weapon to show his unpopularity. Ping pushed for an independent recount of the vote. Allegations of fraud led to deadly protests in September when results were announced. Sociologist Abdurrahman Abba of the Omar Bongo University says poor turnout at AFCON may be more an indication of the continued level of political tension than support for the opposition.
En toutes circonstances, dans n'importe quel pays, lorsqu'il survient une crise, règne comme une atmosphère.
He says many people in Gabon are not ready to go to the stadiums for fear of the unknown. Some people, like football fan Narcisse Mumba, prefer to watch the games on television at popular spots like Liberty Square.
If Ali Bongo was popular, Yang Ping wouldn't have been able to convince the people to stay out from this game.
Ali Bongo is unpopular.
President Ali Bongo has not reacted to Ping's call for a boycott, but not everyone has responded kindly to the opposition's attempt to mix politics and football. Ndong Gabriel, a businessman in Libreville, has been going to the stadiums.
C'est par rapport au patriotisme. Je supporte non seulement parce que c'est d'abord la patrie.
He says he is going to the stadium as a sign of patriotism to his country that needs more visibility. He says he is also out to support Africa's football and its youth, who, for the most part, are more highly competitive than their peers on other continents. Some observers say the bad economy, not politics, is keeping fans at home. The global drop in oil prices since 2014 has hurt Gabon and reduced people's purchasing power. Some of the stadiums being used for AFCON matches are far from city centers, which only adds to the expense. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Libreville.
The eight-stringed nyatiti was once a popular instrument in Africa's Great Lakes region, but its use has declined dramatically now. A Kenyan master is teaming up with a young virtuoso to revive the tradition with a new album of nyatiti music. For VOA, Jason Patinkin has the story from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Odwar Nyagweno has been playing the nyatiti, a traditional African instrument, since he was a boy in Kenya's western region. He earned the nickname Nyagweno, meaning spring chicken in the Luo language, for his boundless energy as a young player. He says, "I started when I was 13. When I first saw the instrument and when I first held the instrument, it was a good feeling. It was an indescribable feeling. Now I'm 70 years and I'm still playing." The nyatiti was once popular throughout this part of East Africa. It is made of a wooden resonator covered in goatskin, and players pluck its eight strings like a harp. He says, "Of course, there were many different people who played. We would compete, and if you win, your name became famous. My name went very far." Since those raucous days, the nyatiti has faded in Kenya. Old players passed away, and young people took an interest in rock and hip-hop music. But Nyagweno hopes to keep the instrument alive. He's teamed up with a young virtuoso, 25-year-old Daniel Onyango, and other Nairobi-based musicians to make a full album of classic nyatiti music. He says, "The wisdom this instrument represents is that there are things that the past can teach us. Even like the people today, what we say now can't be said without the words people spoke in the past." Here's a clip from a recent recording session of the two nyatiti players at Nairobi's Alchemist Studio. Onyango has studied under Nyagweno for 7 years. He's taken the nyatiti international, performing in Uganda, Sweden, and the United States. He also gives the old instrument a modern twist, playing the nyatiti in a band that includes electric guitar, saxophone, and drums.
I think one of the unique thing about young people picking up the instrument, they are able to even experiment and come up with new ideas on how to popularize the instrument. People within the urban set, they perceive this as an instrument that you can only play for the tourists. And I think that has had a negative effect on our musical heritage. But also it's a good challenge because there's a more possibility. You automatically stand out among thousands of musicians who play like Western guitar.
Though the nyatiti is traditionally of the Luo tribe, Onyango, who hails from a different tribe, hopes to make the instrument the pride of all Kenyans. Here he sings in the Kikuyu language. For Nyagweno, seeing a new spring chicken play the nyatiti gives him comfort that his legacy won't be lost. He says, I can say that he is like my son. Playing the Nyatiti won't stop with my death. He will continue the traditions of the past. It can't be extinguished yet as long as we are still teaching them. The album, titled Odwar Nyagweno and the Nyatiti Attack, will be released in May by Kenya's Dagoretti Records. Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon. Burkina Faso scored two late goals to beat Tunisia 2-0 and reach the Africa Cup of Nations semifinals. Substitute Aristide Banks scored with a low drive from a free kick only 5 minutes after coming off the bench. Produce Nakolma made sure of the victory on their counter-attack after Tunisia had thrown everyone forward, rounding the goalkeeper 40 yards out before slotting into an empty net. The Stallions will now face either Morocco or Egypt in the last four on Wednesday. It's now 3 wins for their 3 quarter-final appearances for Burkina Faso, who last reached this stage in 2013 when they finished as losing finalists. In the other quarter-final match on Saturday, Liverpool's Sadio Mane missed the decisive spot kick as Cameroon beat Senegal 5-4 on penalties to reach the Africa Cup of Nations semi-finals. Mane, Africa's most expensive player, was denied by Fabrice Ondoa, Vincent Aboubakar hitting the winning penalty. Cameroon are 4-time winners of the tournament. There were striking similarities to this game and 15 years ago, when Cameroon and Senegal met in the 2002 final in Mali. On that occasion, Cameroon beat Senegal 3-2 on penalties after a goalless 120 minutes. Meanwhile, DR Congo take on Ghana in the other African Cup of Nations quarter-final on Sunday, while Egypt play Morocco. In tennis, Roger Federer has won his 18th Grand Slam title and first for 5 years with a thrilling 5-set victory over Rafael Nadal in the Australian Open final. The 35-year-old Swiss won 6-4, 3-6, 6-1, 3-6, 6-3, claimed his 5th Melbourne title and extend his lead at the top of the all-time men's major winners list. Nadal remains tied in second with Pete Sampras on 14 Grand Slams following his first final since 2014. Federer's previous major title came at Wimbledon in 2012. He becomes the first man in history to win 5 or more titles at 3 different Grand Slam events, 5 Australian Opens, 5 US Opens, and 7 Wimbledons. Nadal was also on the way back from injuries that curtailed his 2016 season, but the Spaniard could not improve his winning record against Federer. The Swiss has now won 12 of their 35 matches and 3 of 9 major finals. On Saturday, Serena Williams beat sister Venus in straight sets to win her 7th Australian Open and an open-era record 23rd Grand Slam singles title. Serena won 6-4, 6-4 to pass Steffi Graf in the all-time list of major winners since the Grand Slams accepted professional players in 1968. The American regained the number one ranking from German Angelique Kerber. Australia's Margaret Court, with 24, is the only player still ahead of Serena in terms of Grand Slam single titles. Saturday's final was the 28th installment of the Sisters on Court rivalry, which began at the Australian Open back in 1998, with Serena now 17-11 ahead and 7-2 up in Grand Slam finals. Venus, who turned professional in 1994 and has won 5 Wimbledon and 2 US Open titles, insisted she was not too disappointed after reaching her first major final since 2009. Finally, in athletics, the former world record holder Wilson Kipsang will face nine other men with sub-2.07 personal bests at the Tokyo Marathon when he lines up for the IAAF Gold Label Road Race on February 26th. Now, in its 11th year, the Tokyo Marathon course has been adapted by eliminating several hills in the closing stages, so organizers are hopeful that the Japanese all-comers record of 2.05 will be challenged. Kipsang broke the marathon world record in 2013 and improved his best last year. The 34-year-old, who took Olympic bronze in 2012, has run faster than 2.05 every year from 2010 to 2016. Kipsang will line up against 2004 Tokyo Marathon champion Dickson Chumba, 2008 Olympic and 2009 World Bronze medalist Segaye Kabede, 2013 World Bronze medalist Tadese Tola, and Kenya's Bernard Koech, all of whom have personal best faster than 2.05. Meanwhile, Kenya's Bessie Saina is the most intriguing entrant for the women's race. The 28-year-old will be making her marathon debut in Tokyo, but expectations will be high after a stellar 2016 season, which included a fifth-place finish in the 10,000 meters at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games, where she clocked a personal best of 30.07.78. She went on to record a personal best of 1.07.22 to win the Great Scottish Half Marathon in just her second race over the distance. Saina will face a trio of top Ethiopians, including 2015 Tokyo Marathon winner Bethane Dibaba. The 23-year-old finished fifth in Tokyo last year and second in 2014, setting a lifetime best of 2:22.30. Compatriot Amane Berisso recorded one of the fastest marathon debuts of all time when she finished second in Dubai last year in 2 hours, 20 minutes and 48 seconds. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Kublan, yeah, Oluchi, yeah. Mix Monsa. Mix Monsa.
Plenty, plenty. on the maga. Karo de make my head the turn. Karo de make my head the bang. Karo de make my head the scatter. Hey, I'm looking for Karo.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music selection from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Oman's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is appropriate to offer warm congratulations to the Economic Commission of West Africa, ECOWAS, the African Union, and the United Nations Security Council for the manner in which they managed the crisis in the Gambia without bloodshed. It was indeed a win-win solution. President Yame was warned by these institutions that if he should continue to hold on to power, he would not be recognized by these institutions as a legitimate government. On the other hand, both the African Union and ECOWAS agreed to certain requests by Yame about his security and his assets, although it is not certain to what extent the new president agreed to all the terms. But what we do know now is that the new president of the Gambia rode joyously to his capital in Banjul last Thursday. Good congratulations. However, there are many people who are worried that this firmness shown by the Security Council, ECOWAS, and the African Union is because the problem of the Gambia was rather simple. it was a low-hanging fruit with little complications militarily. So what will now be required is to prove that these institutions can stand up to principles that will be applicable throughout the continent. And the test case is that of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. In previous commentaries, we have examined the devious ways that the Kabila government used to prolong his mandate in the DRC. But the counter encountered very strong opposition, particularly by the Rassemblement. And the Catholic Church did intervene, and we now have a negotiated transitional arrangement. And I want to stress, this is a negotiated transition agreement. It's not a prolongation of the mandate of President Kabila in the DRC. Already we know that they have agreed on the number of cabinet posts, although not the appropriate portfolios. Regrettably, it has become a very large cabinet of over 50, with Kabila retaining about 21 cabinet posts. We can argue, of course, that the DRC is a very large country and may be difficult to manage. But there must be watchful eye, particularly by the African Union, as to how the terms of this transitional agreement should be implemented. President Kabila and his supporters are trying still to maneuver to assert their full control of the transitional government. They are arguing that the opposition should present at least 5 names for prime minister, arguing that they could not impose a prime minister on the president. But the president should understand that by accepting him to lead the transition arrangement, this was a compromise by the opposition, and therefore an equal bargain must be for him to accept the prime minister presented by the opposition. So how this is resolved will be extremely important. The Security Council and the African Union should also be prepared to tell President Kabila and his supporters that should they fail to carry out the terms of the transitional agreement, recognition will be withdrawn from his government. This is very important, as it did in the Gambia, that his government will no longer be recognized as heading the country of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Hopefully, if this should succeed, we will have instruments by which some order could be brought to the African continent, particularly in those countries where the presidents are still reluctant to leave power, even though these things are demanded by their constitutions. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you lament not the dead, but lament the trouble of making a grave. The way of the ghost is longer than the grave. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Often, these individuals are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. These are frequently people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such individuals are identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the specially designated nationals list. Their assets within U.S. reach are immediately blocked, and they are effectively locked out of the global financial system. As a result, no U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with designated individuals. In this way, the United States deters participation in terrorism and disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. Such are the cases of Ali Damush and Mustafa Mugniyeh. Both men, top leaders of the Lebanon-based Hezbollah terrorist organization, have recently been named by the United States Department of State as specially designated global terrorists under Executive Order 13224. Ali Damush is the head of Hezbollah's Foreign Relations Department, an organization that engages in covert terrorist operations around the world on behalf of Hezbollah and includes recruiting operatives and gathering intelligence. Mustafa Mugniyeh is a Hezbollah commander who once led Hezbollah's operation in the Golan Heights and helped organize the group's terrorist infrastructure. He is the nephew of former Hezbollah military commander Mustafa Badreddin and the son of Imad Mugniyeh, the former chief of Hezbollah military and terrorist operations. The imposition of sanctions by the United States against terrorists like Damush and Mugniyeh notifies the American public and the international community that Ali Damush and Mustafa Mugniyeh are actively engaged in terrorism. Such designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate organizations and individuals and assist or complement the law enforcement actions of U.S. agencies as well as those of other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.